fantasy, caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies.
Welcome back to Deep Thoughts. Today we're going to discuss suicide. When I asked for suggestions, I got at least two people mentioning suicide, which I thought was interesting because in looking over all of the psychological emotions that we have as human beings and considering them for episode topics, suicide has been rattling around in my brain because when I was really young, I understood it. And I've definitely seen friends of mine from high school and people that I know in the world throughout my life engage in it. We've obviously all lost celebrities who have engaged in it. And so I think it's just a very important thing. And because it's sort of a taboo thing that no one really talks about, the problem is if an individual finds themselves in it, they're sort of in a domain of existence that is pretty isolating, right? You don't go to your average drink hole or smoke lounge and you talk to your buddies and you go, hey, was anybody here sort of suicidal? Because I was having that feeling today, blah, 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 you know? No one does that. It's this embarrassing thing to be so defeated that you could possibly want to exit what is perceived to be this feedback loop of pain. So I think it's worth talking about. Now, my experience with it, if you've listened to the entire Deep Thoughts Radio, Deep Thoughts Radio, the MK Ultra Radio episodes from last year, I told a story about when I was a kid, probably about 23, I think it was. I had gotten into a romantic, you know, relationship. I'd been in a relationship for 2.5 years, or probably 2 years at the time, and was in love with this girl. She was, about 9 years older than me at the time. And we'd been together for a long time and been through a lot of thick and thin stuff, and it just started falling apart at one point, and I had relocated from Los Angeles to the Bay Area with her. So I made a lot of big sacrifices in my life and really left behind, you know, screenwriting. I didn't realize, you know, what I was leaving behind, but acting and screenwriting and a bunch of other Hollywood-based things for the time being. And it just, I didn't like the area up there, you know, so I found it very hostile. And, you know, was just at the cusp of the invention of the internet being a household word, so I didn't realize that a bunch of good times were coming. But I had gotten to a point where she was visibly breaking up with me very slowly. And what was kind of funny was that I asked her later why she broke up with me, and she accused me of something that clearly another guy did to her at a party, not me. I said, well, why did you do this, you know, are you with another guy? She wasn't physically with another guy, but she dated somebody else. And she says, because you made fun of my dress at that party. And I go, that wasn't me. That was your aunt's buddy who came over. Remember? You had the two chicks and he made fun of you and you went and destroyed your dress. The look on her face was like, oh my God, you're right. I've been cheating on you, thinking that you did something that someone else did. I've never had that happen before in my life, but that's what happened. It's really odd. But there was one point where I kind of felt like I was in that diminishing return. You know, as much as I tried to mend things, just wasn't going anywhere. And what's really strange is I can't remember the day that I'm going to tell you about. I can't remember why it felt so depressing. But I woke up, I managed to spend the night with her at her aunt's house. And she had, for some reason, she pulled out of her apartment and was just kind of staying with her aunt. And I think she eventually moved in with this guy. She's married to him to this day, the dude that she was dating on the side for about 6 months. So I think it's great. I mean, for me, in the end, she won, and both of them won, and I couldn't be more happy for both of them. But at the time, it was hard. But I woke up and I remember just, when I look back on it, you know, when you see time in your brain of your past, sometimes you can feel the moment, like when my parents said, hey, we're going to go see Star Wars in 1977. I remember the day. I remember how it was a beautiful summer, early summer day in Kansas, and I just felt awesome. And I remember getting ready, getting my best clothes on, you know, and going to see the movie. I remember sitting in the theater, this disco ball that they hit with a light, and I'd never seen that in my lifetime. So I thought, man, this is just a magical moment. And then, of course, Star Wars happens. Cool. But when I think back to this moment with this girl, I have no reference of feeling depressed. I just know that I can say that dude, who isn't me, was really depressed. And so I got up. And I went to the store, and I was going to do sleeping pills. Yeah, I'm talking about attempted suicide, right? So when I say, I've been there, well, I've been there. But actually took action, right? And there were blue pills. And of course, anybody who knows these pills, if you take a lot of them now, they have a throw-up medicine inside it. So if you take too many, it makes you barf, which is just brilliant, just awesome. But I bought orange juice and I bought a bunch of other crap just to make sure my bag didn't look, suicidal. My suicide vest of myself here. Took it home. I was just going to skip work that day. I didn't, I had work, but I don't even think I called in. I just didn't go to work, which to this day sort of baffles me. Now I'm self-employed, so, you know, I work from home sometimes and I go to the clients. Places sometimes, but anyway, I take this stuff and I put it out on a chopping board on my stove. I had a little studio apartment, and I took a rolling pin and I just crushed a ton of them, right? And it's just this blue pile of, you know, Breaking Bad meth looking stuff. So somehow I must have scooped it up and I put it into this big cup. I had one of these I don't know what the deal was. When big plastic cups came out at fast food restaurants in the 90s, we used to keep them and collect them at the house and use them as cups, especially when you're single, right? And so I had this big thing of orange juice. I pour this stuff in there. So I got blue plus orange, and it was like this hulky green shit in there. It was hilarious, right? The second I saw it, I pretty much was starting to laugh on my own. And so then it's this moment of truth. Do I have the balls to drink this stuff? And so I just took one giant gulp of this stuff. And it was the most bitter, gross stuff on planet Earth. I immediately sort of laughed, and it just shocked me out of what I was doing, how silly what it was that, you know, what I was doing was tasting and looking and all that stuff. Because you can kind of start to see how stupid you look, you know, you start going outside your own brain. So of course I have a sink right there, so I just pour it all in the sink and flush it out and just kind of go, well, I just need a day off is really what I need, right? Not to kill myself. And so I go and I sit on my bed, and I think my dad had got me my first TV in California, because I just wasn't interested for like four or five years. This would have been about 93. I got here in 87. It's about 6 years. My dad sent me a TV because he keeps wanting me to see shows and then talk about it, you know. But for the first 6 years in California, if I saw a television, it was because the place I rented a room had one, or I was just somewhere public place or friend's house, right? Imagine that, a kid from 18 to 23 not watching television. No wonder I got ahead in life, right? So I sit on this bed, and this is the important part for my particular story. And then we're going to get into the real deal, because this almost sounds so silly, it doesn't feel like the real deal, but it was. I sit on this bed, and I'm on the left edge of my bed. It's about a 3 feet, 3 foot area, and then there's like a sliding screen door for my patio. I'm on the first floor of this apartment complex. And it's daylight, and I have this white carpet in the room, so every time you walk across the room, all these little fibers are falling in the sky, you know, inside your room. And, the pills start kicking in. And I remember before I got up and pounded this RC Cola can I had in my refrigerator, I had one caffeinated drink in the entire place. I looked over to the edge where the carpet was, and I kid you not, I absolutely hallucinated where I was headed if this were to succeed. And there were no angels, and there were no Jesus images, but the floor absolutely fell away. Just absolutely disappeared, like the third act of Time Bandits, the Terry Gilliam movie. Funded by George Harris from the Beatles. But it was an abyss down there. And the edge of my bed turned into almost like a marble slate all the way down. And the message that came up from the pit as I was staring into it, it was almost like this vision, this voice of meaning, not a voice you hear, said, if you ever do this again, this is where you're going, and you're not going to like it. Now, I don't mean to freak people out who've lost people. I think for me in my life, at that point in my life, I had so much going for me, and I've had so much invested in me from those who were gone and those who run the universe. I think that that's what the message meant. I didn't have any reason to be here. I wasn't really suffering, really. Some people really suffer, but I wasn't at that level. Right? So after that, I never had those thoughts again, because I'd been there right up to the cusp of it, and I pulled back. And you know, I mentioned a part in one of the other episodes where in the late 90s, I was working for a company that was a good company, but they were just upside down. I remember going to bed at night and thinking about jumping off a building, like a World Trade Center building, just jumping off. And it wasn't death. It was freedom. And I wasn't dying in my vision. I just was like, I will get away from you regardless of what it takes. And that's going to be a big thing I'm going to share with you and suggest to you if you get to this point. So, suicide is a very, very specific issue, right? It's going to be tough, I'm just going to say up front, it's going to be tough for me to engage exactly the dimension of reality you're in if you have any of these feelings, or if you know anyone who has these feelings, because it's so utterly relative to where we are in life. And the younger you are, the more dangerous having these thoughts can be. Now, some of us grew up as young people, and we had older people around us that we really respected. Adults that we simply said, they have made great decisions, and I want to be in their shoes when I get older. You know, maybe you want to be more wealthy than they are, or live in a different place, but psychologically speaking, you're like, they're happy, and I want to be like them. And you have access to them. You talk to them. And they have access to you, and they can look at you, and they can see when you're not feeling well mentally, and step in and say, you know, what's up? Anything I can do for you? Or they don't even say anything. They just say, we're going fishing. We're going to Disneyland. We're going to go to the beach. We're going to go see a movie. Whatever. They just kind of know you need that push, right? But there are some of you who either have no adults in your life that you respect. Some of you just have no adults. Some of you have adults that you cannot respect because they're overgrown children. And I'm going to say that there's been a flavor of that through all time, but I'm also going to say that right now in world history, I think it's probably an epidemic of uneducated, childish parents. I think that there's a massive amount of that, and I'm in that generation. Right? Every parent makes mistakes as well. When a parent, and you can, I have a whole parenting episode you can see, but when a parent either only disciplines for a short period of time and then stops disciplining, and they lose this bond with you, and you're going off and making decisions that aren't the best decisions for you, which puts you in a situation where you feel depressed, or if they don't discipline you at all until the second you need their help, right? When that happens, you don't have a bond with anyone that you respect. And some of you are tied to your parents like they're, like the umbilical cord was never severed. Some ways I envy that, and some ways I'm really glad that didn't happen to me. You know, I'm my own man, 100%. My parents are these beautiful people that I know and love and respect, but they're not me, you know? And I will mourn their death like I mourn any friend of mine, but it won't be any extra mourning, you know, because I will mourn my friend's death to the ultimate level, and my parents are in that camp, right? There's no less or more. Everybody gets the same level of respect from me. But the reason why I mentioned the parent-child association, because if you're young, the thing that I have seen in my history of life are parents that, in trying to love their children, they put down a tremendous level of rules on their children. The more that you have a lack of knowledge of how to actually engage your child and get them to see the benefits of one decision over the other, the more is that the punishment and the paradigm of living becomes arbitrary. And what do I mean by that? One of the most brilliant things my mother told me when I was young is she said, "I will never ground you." And I said, "Well, that's great, Mom, but why is that?" I'm like 9 or 10 years old when she's telling me this. And she goes, "Because a parent that grounds is a parent that has lost complete control. And they have arbitrarily sanctioned the movement of the child." And I think that she must have read that somewhere, but whoever thought that up is more profoundly intelligent than you could possibly imagine. And I'm going to give you one of the reasons why grounding is a bad idea. A child makes a mistake in a finite amount of time, right? They commit one sin against the family, right? They hide candy in their bedroom and eat it in the bed at night. Perhaps they stole something from a brother, sister, from a store, but they have committed a crime in a finite blip of time. To punish them as if they're in some sort of federal penitentiary, where the punishment goes on for days and days and days. The problem with that association of finite moment in time for the sin and a prolonged period of time for the punishment for a child. I'm not talking about adults who go to prison. Adults can understand the attrition of what they've done. A child can't, or they could, but they'd have to be, you know, raised perfectly from the bottom up, and none of us raise our kids perfectly, right? But it starts to build a metaphor and symbology of the household, of their bedroom, where they have to go to bed at night and get ready in the morning. However you're grounding your child, it starts to turn their environment into a prison. That's what the grounding thing does. Even timeouts, right? Go stare in the corner or whatever the hell, however you want to enforce that. It starts to turn the household into a paradigm of punishment. So by the time the child gets the opportunity to get in the car and drive off with their friends, of course they want out of this prison that you've created by grounding them. And this is where I have seen children 17 and below kill themselves, because their household becomes an incredible prison. And even though it's irrational, and even though their parents love them dearly, they are not mature enough to know. And so death is just like a kid getting a tattoo, right? A kid under 18 getting a tattoo is crazy. They can't conceive of forever, and they're putting something that's forever on their body. And the parents that endorse this kind of stuff blow my mind. Good for you, Bobby. You got those, you know, the state of California on your head, you know. It's nuts. But I want to tell you a story that I think carries more depth and meaning than I can ever put behind it. But me just telling you the story will help you just get it. This is going to be kind of a gruesome story about a suicide. One of my friends from a long time ago got a job in a paddy wagon picking up dead bodies for the coroner. And he was just pinched for money and he just had to have a job. And so he got this job. And one of his very first jobs, pickups, was he went to this house where a minor, 16, 17-year-old son, had put a shotgun in his mouth and blew his brains out, blew the top of his head off. And he is sitting at a desk in his bedroom, which is, if you just look back from where the chair was, it's this door to his bedroom, which leads to a hallway, which leads to the front room, which leads to the front door. So my buddy has to go and see something utterly gruesome. Now, I'm just at the face value of the imagery that I just put in your brain. Think about a minder that managed to get himself to such an act of despair, to a state of despair, I should say, that he took his own life with a shotgun. The only silver lining would be that obviously he didn't feel anything. But when my friend was there, he is to pick up all the mess. You have a full body that weighs a lot that's got to go inside of a bag. And you have fragments of his head all over the room. For those of you in suicide mode, I want you to think about for a split second the gruesomeness that someone else has to experience if you happen to kill yourself. You're taking a lot of people down with you. But now think about this. Something happened. This kid's 16, 17 years old. You know, I've nearly lived in this house 16, 17 years, right? Shy about 3 years. The father is pacing the hallway. And my friend is obviously seeing something for the very first time in his life. The inside of somebody's head. Brain matter everywhere. The father is pacing, and he said the father would walk to the end of the hallway where the son's body is visible through the door jamb, and his father would say, "I hate you." And then his father would walk and pace back two or three times, and then sobbing, he would say, "I love you." This poor father lost the bond with his son. And something went wrong. And we know that in this world, as I've always said to you, it's not the big decisions that you make in life that change your life the most. It's the thousands of little decisions that you make. Losing the engagement with your children or your parent, depending on how old you are listening to this, it's a bunch of little decisions that you made to perhaps spite the other person or to maybe do what you might think is tough love. But I would say that it's not worth it to experiment like that. Passive-aggressive, silent treatments probably made this moment possible for this father-son duo. Now, what do you think the life was like for the rest of that guy's life, who has the vision of his son splattered all over his bedroom, knowing that probably there's no way for him to completely absolve himself from some of the responsibility of his son committing suicide? If the son had a mother who was still alive, the father's got to make that phone call. The father's got to take this kid's body to the cemetery, to a church, bury the kid, and then try to go on living life, right? So that's a perspective of a moment where the tumultuous positive negative was going on at the same exact time. I hate you and I love you. He hate what his son had done, most likely, but he still loves his son more than anything. Every parent really does most of the time, right? Even if they say they don't, they just, it's okay to hate a moment in someone's life, right? Well, let's go back into the person's mind of someone who's on the edge. I'm going to say some low-hanging fruit things right off the bat. And I'm going to say them, and they're going to sound... I'm going to try not to make them sound cliche, but I'm going to tell you the only reason why they sound cliche is because they've been said so many times by people who know what they're talking about. So let's say you are on... Well, there's two sides to it, right? You're ebbing towards a suicidal loop, because it happens, right? There's this feeling of suicidal tendencies, and it for some of you, it will come, and you'll have the feeling, and then it goes away. No, of course not. Now, for any of you who've had a child, I think that once you see your child enter this world, I think any act of your selfishness goes out the door, right? You have to be there for your child, regardless if they like you or not, forever. And for all of you who think you have a child who hates you, well, that always changes. That always changes, okay. I've seen criminals who've done horrible things, have children that disown them for 5 years, and then they manage to figure out a way to approach their parents and love them. But so you might be ebbing towards these thoughts, or you might be in a solid stream of this thought. I just got to go. It's just going to be better that I let go. And some of you may have this thought because you're in physical pain 24/7. I will say that with physical pain, your body will eventually reset, and the mean of existence is the pain threshold that you grow up, that you wake up with every single day, and you'll simply not notice it because your brain won't allow you to notice it. So if you've lost a limb or you've gotten sick or whatever, and it's new pain to you physically, it will balance out. I know it sounds crazy, but that's what happens, right? But here's the low-hanging fruit that I absolutely, positively promise you, this is the truth, all right? And I need you to hang on to this as if it is the utter oracle of truth when it comes to you're about to punch out. The more you're about to punch out right now, this is for you. One, tomorrow absolutely, positively does not equal today. All right. It is foolish of us, and I am right there in the camp with you, because I don't have suicidal feelings anymore, but I definitely get to a point sometimes where if a chain of things go wrong, it's sometimes I need to kick myself in the butt to realize that tomorrow is another day, right? But it takes energy to be negative, you know? And you won't have the energy to be negative. As time passes, you will let go and you will just become your ambient, beautiful self. But regardless of what sucks in front of you right now, a year from now, your life could be utter and complete bliss. Like I said in that episode back there, when I was dreaming about or daydreaming about jumping off buildings because I couldn't stand where I worked, as a metaphor for escaping imprisonment, 1 year later, I had the dream job of my life. I was making $50,000 more, and I was already paid a ton of money at this previous place. I had managed to start a business relationship with one of my movie mentors. Like, my life completely and utterly changed. And there was nothing special, you know? I just applied, you know? Of course, I did have my skill sets and all that kind of stuff, but you can attain skills. That's fun. If you're younger and you're having these feelings, then I could just tell you that getting older, it will change everything. It's going to be completely different and so much fun. So just chill out, would you? If someone's broken your heart, there's that old saying, there's a lot of fish in the sea. And I hate that saying, but let me just do some math for you, all right? There's 350 million people in America. I don't know where you are. And there's only, you know, there's only maybe, I don't know, 20 million you could possibly date. And out of 20 million, maybe there's only 10 million that you probably could marry. And out of those 10 million, there's probably only 2 million that would be the utter perfect soulmate for you. So relax if someone broke your heart. Just relax. Just know there's a couple million more people out there so perfectly, perfectly ready for you. And you know what the odds are? Unless you're Larry King, they're alive right now. They're alive right now and breathing. They're beautiful, beautiful faces, bodies, spirits, minds, creativity, whatever you're attracted to. They're alive right now. And you know what? Unless you're planning on moving away, they probably live really close to you right now. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? The person that is the person of your dreams is alive and lives next to you. You just got to go find them. Go to the restaurants, go to the bars, go to wherever, go to the gym, talk to strangers in line at the coffee place that you go to. That's the beautiful thing about getting dumped. Hey, and I'll tell you what, I've dated my share of women in my lifetime, and I'll say that the ones that didn't work out, I got no regrets, you know? I mean, I would say like, maybe I wish I was nicer at a particular point in time, or I wish I hadn't made a particular decision to be somewhere, but that's not a big regret. That's just like, I wish I could change that little moment in life. There's another cliche that is absolutely dead on, and it's actually super exciting when you really conceive of it. If you think you're on the bottom, you have totally and utterly bottomed out. And you're even telling people that. The most beautiful thing is that the only place you can go up from the bottom, the only place you can go from the bottom is up. I know that sounds like a cliche, but there's a reason why it's said, because it's 150,000% true. But I want to give you some tricks of the trade. That if you buy into what I'm saying to you, I'll give you a couple things you can do. One, most of us have a circle of, depending on how old you are, most of us have a circle of family that either we feel close enough to tell them that we're suicidal, or we wouldn't dare tell them we're suicidal because some people are worried about being judged. Anytime I date somebody and they're like, they're all, well, my sisters judge me and my mother judges me. It's like, grow the fuck up, would you? Seriously. Be your own person, for Christ's sake. Have your own opinion of yourself. No one should own the opinion of you but you, right? But if you can't tell your family that you're feeling suicidal, you got to find one smart friend that you can tell. Just try it. Just say, hey, look, man, I know it's going to sound crazy. I don't want to feel this way, but I'm feeling this way. And I'm just going to reach out. Maybe you can help me. And just say, I'm feeling suicidal. You just say that. Because you'll be amazed what just telling someone, just having it go out of your chest, will do for you. You know? You'll be amazed at what resources they have to distract you away from it, to convince you, to give you a different perspective. And if the person that you tell ends up being a numbskull and doesn't really help you, well, go on to somebody else. Be careful. Don't just knee-jerk telling somebody, you know. Hell, you could maybe prime the pump and talk about someone who's done it, see how they react. That Robin Williams, man, the dude killed himself. What do you think about that? And then they either show intelligence and compassion and empathy towards the situation, then you play your card. Just see what happens. But here is my number one suggestion. If you're feeling to the point where you can't shake it out of yourself, you need to change your environment right away. And what does that mean? Well, it could be two things. Depending on how mobile you are, meaning how much you can change your life, how much you can afford to change your life physically with money or whatever. It depends on where you are in the world. I'm going to give you what I would do in America, living on the West Coast. And I apologize if this doesn't match your European location or what have you. I've said this a couple times, but when I finally went to Hawaii in November of 2013, and I live in Huntington Beach, California, which is exotic, gorgeous place, and you could just go up and down the coast and find more exotic, famous locations, right? From Venice Beach to Malibu to Laguna, La Jolla, It's just an endless beach of beauty here, right? And we're sort of a desert zone where we brought a lot of our plants in here and stuff. And I sort of poo-pooed Hawaii. It just got too famous for me, right? And my family put together this trip. They bought all the tickets, paid for the lodging, which has rarely happened to me in my entire lifetime. I'm always the one paying. And it just happened to coincide with a bad business deal that I had been involved with where in my company, a guy had screwed me $80,000. He'd asked for a favor and then played a bunch of games and said that, he just basically didn't want to pay his money. He paid about 20 in the end, so he screwed me 60 grand. My company was in it for $57,000 worth of payroll. So it was sort of the last straw where I finally just made the decision to stop pushing it forward. It was time for an industry change. So I was sort of in a funk. I was in no suicidal things at all, but I was definitely in a funk. And for me to get in a funk is pretty tough. So I get on this plane and I fly to Hawaii. And the entire time I'm on the plane, excuse me, I'm sort of grumpy. I'm being an asshole. I was an unequivocal dick on this plane. And I wasn't exuding it to anybody. I wasn't pissing on anyone's parade, but I was just quiet and stoic. And I land, luckily, in the old airport at Honolulu. Now, the old airport is where people like Elvis would land, the Rat Pack would land, Don Ho would, leave Hawaii. And I get off, and it is just the most endearing, warm, beautiful place I have ever been in my life. And man, I have been places, right? Of course, I haven't remotely explored the majority of the world by any stretch of the imagination. But I've been all over America, and I've been over some important places in Europe. And I got into this island, and the music and the spirit of the Polynesian people there, it was exactly what I needed. It was exactly what I needed. And I was able to stay there, I think, like 5 days or something like that. It was a weird trip. It wasn't like what I would have normally planned. I usually do 2 weekends and all 5 days of the week in between. And, I didn't feel landlocked or anything like that. And I didn't really have to have an agenda. It was just be there. Suck in the ambience, the music. There's a lot of rum there, too. So why do I tell you my little journey to Hawaii? Well, I was firmly convinced by the time I was done, by the time I left, that if I were to ever, 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 ever reduce to a suicidal state of mind, or even just a prolonged funk, that I would beg, borrow, and steal to get a ticket to go to Hawaii. And I would just be there. They want you to have round-trip tickets when you go, because there's a lot of homeless people there. It's not like a lot that you see it a lot, but it's like any average metropolitan area. But it's so gorgeous that being homeless in Hawaii is almost like being stranded on one of the most beautiful islands. And I just went to Oahu, but you're stranded in one of the most gorgeous places on planet Earth. That's what it feels like. So I can imagine someone doing that. But, buy an open-ended round-trip ticket. If you got to wash dishes in some restaurant to survive there, believe me, you will enjoy your time off in between washing dishes. But now this is what I want to suggest you do. Because typically a suicidal tendency, as I have experienced it, talked about it with people, heard stories about it, is that being trapped and being caged is a very fundamental principle to the feeling. Being stuck in a house, Now, some of you are going to feel perhaps this way, and it's because you're physically limited. Perhaps you're stuck in a hospital bed, you're infirm somehow, and you're not able to do what I just said. There probably are some extreme things that can be done even in that scenario, but if you're in that scenario, I'm hoping that you're in a temporary moment of healing or a physical care, that even if it takes a year to 5 years to get out of that situation, you do have the light at the end of the tunnel, that there is something there for you. And I'll try to loop back if you know, because I'm a solitude expert as well, right? But I think the first thing you want to do, if you can, is change your environment. Go on a vacation if you possibly can, you know? And you may not want to do this as a knee-jerk reaction to having a depressing day. You probably want to get to a point where we don't want to run away from the things that make us feel this way, right? If every time you got dumped by somebody or something didn't work out, and you, if you were to immediately go to a suicidal frame of mind, then that's dangerous within you. We need to work on your mechanism inside to say, hey, life is a bunch of peaks and valleys. And that's just life. And they never tell you that when you're young. And that's the problem. We're told on television through happy endings and movies that it's mostly a peak. And if you ever go into a valley, you are failing. Right? And I have seen this in people. I've dated people that the first time they have a valley, they just crap all over themselves. They're not necessarily suicidal, but the next step up from suicidal is self-destructive. You know, alcoholism. I did a whole episode on alcoholism, and at the time I was around someone who was beyond privileged, moping and crying that somehow life was hard. And it was, when I got a chance to look back over probably the last 20 years of her life, it was all about utter denial. And if you, and this person would love to complain in the room, right, around you, and eventually just kind of go, okay, let's solve this problem. Let's just at least try to solve this problem that you know, you're hiding your alcoholism for. And I got this funny statement of that I was lecturing, right? We've all had that word, the lecturing word. Lecturing, someone saying that someone's lecturing you, is a self-defense mechanism to essentially continue failing in life. That's what it is. And this person had no knowledge at all in what she was talking about that was just driving her nuts. And I have plenty of experience, plenty of knowledge in the areas where she can't figure it out. And for someone to chicken shit out and say, you're lecturing me, I don't want to be lectured to. It's just like it's an adult taking a pouty way out the back door to continue screwing up their life so they get depressed and drink. And potentially in the end, do themselves in physically or just take their own lives, right? We don't want to be those people. We don't want to do that. If you're a Deep Thoughts listener, you're in a club, man. You're in a club. I'm your buddy, your peer. I'm just one guy in the room, right? There's a lot of great people in these threads. Brilliant people, sweet people, you know, reach out. But now let's talk about, to finish up the whole idea of going somewhere, I'm going to tell you that whatever you have to do to go someplace different, physically. And it's whatever your definition is, right? It might be that you live in London and you're trapped in some flat somewhere, or you're in some weird rural neighborhood and you need to get out to the country. Maybe for you, Hyde Park is just fine, you know? If you're in Los Angeles, maybe just going to the beach, just doing it, right? You don't need anybody with you, but if you can find someone to go with you, it's great. But just go by yourself. If it's warm, take a pair of shorts. Wear a pair of shorts. If it's kind of cold, bring a blanket. If there's anybody you can take with you, take them with you. You know? But now let's go into the more internal version of suicide. The more internal version of depression. You are not really disturbed by your environment as much as I might have said. You're really struggling with a battle inside your mind and inside your heart and soul. You've had goals, opportunities, and you've missed them. And it's your general feeling that, well, those opportunities are now gone. So what do I have to live for, right? Again, if you're stuck physically in a room, we'll try to loop back on that one separately. I was stuck in a room once for like 8 days or something like that as a kid. And when I was 14, I was staring at the wall the whole time. So I have a little, tiny bit of insight into that. Now, the thing about goals and keeping yourself motivated to keep going is that it's all relative to what you're capable of doing when you have the goals. So let's say that you're 35 to 40, sort of where you get the midlife crisis thing going. Not everybody has them, just so you know. But you may not have it in a way that you got to go buy a motorcycle or a Corvette. You just might have it in a way that you feel it. And you look back, excuse me, on your 20s, and you're like, damn, I made a bad decision there. If I could just take back that one decision, look how my life would be better. Now, I've had an incredible life. Incredible life. I did my resume the other day, and I'm telling you, it's like, geez, I've got 3 different resumes with essentially 2 complementary degree, complementary disciplines in each one of them, right? Being a manager, being a CEO, being an engineer, being an architect, being a designer and an artist. And I've still got game design and a bunch of other stuff. And so I've been all these different careers in my life, and I've just lived a charmed life. But yeah, I could go back in time and flip one bit. One little tiny decision I made, and who knows where I would have ended up. Maybe it would have been a train wreck. Who knows, right? But here's what I don't do. For those of you on the cusp of looking at your life and maybe regretting something, so the nice thing is if you're young, man, you got nothing to worry about, you know? You might think you do, but don't worry. This is one mentor to you, right? I want an old guy to a young guy. Let's put it that way. So let's not use mentor. You just need to push reset on what it is you're looking to do, you know? And that's what old people need to do. So if you're 35 and over, and you're looking back on your life, and, you know, again, you could be in your 60s, and you're thinking, damn, nobody hires people in their 60s. Not true, but it is tougher. Someone has a choice. You usually have more expenses in your 60s, depending on how you've geared your life and how much property you've purchased and payments you have. But what you need to do is rebuild your goals from what you can accomplish at the age that you are with the resources that you have. And if you need different resources, do what you can to go get those resources and embed them in your life. All right? I know a lot of guys who are my dad's age, which is like late 60s, and they have massive talents. Incredible talents. One guy is like an incredible craftsman. He can build the most gorgeous inlaid tabletop you've ever seen in your life, right? He doesn't live in the Midwest anymore, but he did. Those tables, the kind of that he creates with leaves on them, and just, you know, they're expandable and all kinds of crazy stuff. They're easily a $5,000 table. Easily. He could probably sell the damn thing for cash, which means he doesn't have to lose half his money to the IRS, right? But they forget they have those talents. Same guy used to build, the good thing about that dude is that he's in China and he's doing amazing things with his skill sets, like crazy cool stuff. But if he had needed a fallback, he's got this to fall back on. He also used to make jewelry, tons of jewelry, like beautiful brass belt buckles with total custom inlaid designs. They're so utterly gorgeous that in this day and age, you think, what factory did that? It's never too late to start a talent. Ever, ever, ever. When I was a young kid in my teens, one of the coolest things that happened to me was my grandfather and I went off and learned wood whittling. And I guess I didn't say wood, but as opposed to a bar of soap, I guess. But he, my grandmother just came at me one day and said, your grandfather wants to take you to his whittle group. And I was like, oh, what's this? Oh, yeah, they learn how to, you know, you learn how to do wood and do all these patterns and stuff you could do. And I was like, okay, this is totally random. But I went, and it was a huge collection of kids from my high school, some kids from the junior high, and all their fathers and grandfathers in this awesome room carving all this crazy stuff. I mean, beautiful stuff, right? And I remember asking how long people, I look at this amazing thing, you know, it's from this old guy. And in my brain, he's been doing this his whole life. And I asked the dude, I said, well, you know, how long you been doing this? Thinking I'm going to hear 20, 30 years. About 6 months. Really? You never did this before? No. This group, they just taught me, you know, the techniques. And I just thought, wow. At that point, I learned it's never too late to bring in new skills, do something fun. But here's the way I look at life nowadays, and maybe you can usurp this. If something can't kill you, then you're good, right? Some of you might have crushing debt. You owe your bank tons of money. You own the IRS tons of money. All right. Well, the first thing about the IRS is that they're, believe it or not, they're pretty cool about payments. I've got friends of mine upside down, $100,000 and plus, millions of dollars. And they pay whatever they can pay. But they can't kill you, right? They can't show up and they can't kill you. Now, if you engage in fraud, sure, someone could put you in jail, right? Remember, financial crime is worse than anything else in this world, right? Because bankers run the world. But most of us don't have those problems. Even if you did, there's always a way out. There's always a way to set up a payment plan. Always, always, always. But with being stuck in the bed, with being stuck in a place where you can't freely move around, and maybe you're just handicapped, we know that people have broken down the barriers of handicappedness, right? You're in a wheelchair, and you never thought you would be. Either you're older or you're younger and you've been injured. Now, I think you can just pull up the internet and find people that play basketball, that play hockey, that surf. They ride motorcycles. They drive cars. There's no problem, man. You could have one operating pinky, and some guy has built a spaceship. He can drive with that pinky. There's a whole world you can reach out to get involved. And just literally reach out to them and say, look, I am really not dealing with not having legs that at least work or exist, and I need just help. You know, there's professional groups out there that do this, and I'm kind of being silly and saying what to do, but if you were to find yourself isolated, if you're watching this, you know, maybe you did find yourself isolated. But here's the thing. Your number one friend, and I probably should have gotten to this earlier, but your number one friend in suicidal thoughts, depression, is change. Change is your number one friend. Remember that old saying, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting something to change. So the beautiful thing is that change is usually free. That's the cool thing. Change your environment. If nothing more for just a vacation, move. Utterly move. If you are married to someone who's driving you crazy and you've tried conceivably everything that you can try, then change. Separate. Spend some time apart. And if you don't want to rile up the bee's nest because you're not sure you want to actually commit to an actual separation, find an excuse to be somewhere for a week or two without the other person. Hey, you're going to be doing that other person a favor, even if it's a bit of a white lie. You know, if you think that your spouse is mature enough, simply tell them. Because communication is the number one thing to keep all this from going crazy. Parents, if you've lost control of your kids and you're feeling horrible about it, maybe your kid's acting suicidal, take them and yourself somewhere wonderful, sit them down, stare them in the face, and just tell them how you feel. Just say, kid, I think I might have screwed up. And I love you more than anything on this planet. And I realize we've slipped apart from each other. Let's bridge that gap and let's have some fun. You know, I don't even know what fun is. You tell me what you think fun might be. You know, maybe retrack your steps. Things that you did in the past that were fun, right? You might need to move to a different part of the world. If you're in a lush Washington state here in America, maybe moving to Phoenix, Arizona is what you're looking for, the dry heat. I'm not even joking, right? Maybe move to Havasu where you want the dry heat, but you want water by you because you're a beach person. Maybe you're in the desert and you need to go to lush forest. Maybe America is not your thing. Maybe you got to move to another country. You know? Maybe the job you have, you need to change. What I find is this. There's an old saying in the Bible, I have no idea where this is said, but it was told to me several times by different people. So I think it's in there. But it was that, don't worry about the birds. God will feed the birds. Which is sort of a rhetorical way of saying, don't worry about the world. God will make sure you're okay. And that's not a Christian thing. It's just the universe seems to provide. Now, I know people that have nosedived in life and it didn't visibly appear as if the universe helped them. But usually when I look at their situations, it's like that old, the old story of the flood. The flood waters start coming in and somebody drives by with a bus and they go, come on, get in the bus, man. Or get in the truck. It's the flood's coming. They're like, no, I'm going to pray to the Lord to save me. And the water keeps going up and they ended up, little boat comes by. They're on top of the roof. Come on, get in the boat. This flood's getting worse. You're going to die. Now I'm praying to the Lord. He's going to save me. And eventually they're standing on top of their chimney and a helicopter comes by and tries to save them. And they say, no, I'm waiting for the Lord. And then finally they die, and they go to heaven, they go, God, why didn't you save me? I prayed to you 3 times. And he goes, man, I sent a truck, a boat, and a helicopter. You didn't get in. So sometimes we just need to get in. So here's the thing about jobs, if jobs are bothering you. And usually it's one asshole at your job that drives you nuts, or you don't think that you're really utilizing who you are as a person. Abuse is something you should never accept, all right? Now, you don't want to be thin-skinned either, right? Sometimes you're the jerk or you're the inconsiderate person and someone's calling you on it. Make a distinction there that you're not doing anything to warrant being abused on average, right? But never work for anyone who abuses you. Ever, ever, ever. I've told a couple employers that throughout my lifetime, and boy, did that just reset the situation. But you can't test the waters of the universe until you take a risk. I think it was Prince back during the Purple Rain era. He had a poster that said something along the bottom that life successes are proportional to your risks. And I'm sure it was said before him in a bunch of different ways, but what an interesting thing to put on a poster of a rock star. Some mentorship about how you gain success. I think it feeds into negative depression feelings. Because if you don't take a risk, and make that change, you won't get any measurable increase in life, you know, in the beauty of life. And so, say you're at a job and you get job disease. And job disease is what I call that feeling of, there's no way I could find another job that'll pay me this much money. There's no way. And so you wait till you get fired or laid off. Most of the time laid off these days. And now you're terrified. Inside, you can't pay your bills and you're terrified. And then you go on all those interviews and you just seem desperate. You smell desperate. You smell terrified. But now what if you had locked out some days when you had the job that you dislike to slowly and calmly find an employer, a new employer? Call in a couple sick days, go on the interview, and now you're relaxed and you're calm because you have a job and your bills are going to get paid, right? There you go. Change. I grew up in a really, really tiny town in Kansas. 10,000 people on average, 12,500 in its big heyday, and probably about 8,500 right now. It's easy to be in a place in the world where you feel trapped. My little hometown is 100 miles from the next metropolitan area. 2 hours. And so it would have been easy for me to feel utterly trapped in a little tiny town. Every once in a while, I would have that feeling that I can't get out of here. What am I doing here? I got bigger things I need to do with life. Even as a kid, a tiny 8-year-old, 12-year-old kid, I remember having those feelings. So when it came time to book, when it came time to considering moving to California, out of my own thought process, it was easy. It was terrifying, but that terrifying was also fun, right? Again, like I said, I moved to California with $236 in my pocket, and I had to spend $100 in gas to get here. I had set up a job, found a place I could squat a room. I came here, started working in the job, squatted the room, didn't pay any rent. Eventually paid the guy $550 for that room for 1 month. Maybe 45 days or something like that. His jaw was on the ground. And hell, that's a lot of money right now for a little room with no furniture, you know. So sometimes the most amazing thing is to reinvent yourself. You don't like your life? Maybe dress different. Maybe do your hair different. Go someplace different. If you don't have anyone you're responsible to, maybe just pick up everything and go. Just go someplace new and just keep driving until you like the vista. You know, if I was an 18-year-old kid stuck in Louisiana, nothing against Louisiana, but let's just say I was stuck in some little town and I'd already had enough of it. Nothing wrong with it, just needed to leave. And maybe I drive to Miami. Maybe I don't like Miami. Maybe I turn around and go to New York. I don't like New York. I just keep driving, right? And I finally just find a place I love and I just look at the one ads, Craigslist, whatever. Boom. Get a crappy little job just to pay for my motel room until I can get a better job. I just keep going and going until I find it. And maybe only spend 6 months there. I don't like that one either, but it's more of what I like. Pick up and go again, right? When you got nothing to lose, you got everything to gain, you know? Seriously. If you're at the point of, let's just put it this way. If you had a credit card and it wasn't completely maxed out, even if it is maxed out, go get another one. If you're feeling like you're suicidal, go get another one. Get yourself about $3,000 to $5,000 on that bad boy. Buy a ticket to Hawaii. Buy a ticket to some exotic place you haven't been. If you live in Hawaii, hell, maybe come to the mainland, go to the desert, whatever. Pick it up and go. Because you having that moment of change and shock to your system may be the only thing you need to never think those thoughts again and to find someone you love. You know, if you're not in love with somebody, you're in love with the wrong person. Amen. There's reasons why people find each other on beaches, you know. I've got plenty of friends who met on beaches and got married on the same beach. They got married with less than 2 months later and lived together forever, right? Weird things will happen. Make life a huge experiment. This is the best massive multiplayer online game you will ever play in your life. And it's free. You know? As opposed to a $15 a month fee. I think you feel me here. Obviously, this is a tough one. Because I wouldn't wish you guys to have a single thought of depression. I don't want any one of you to have any feelings of depression that go to that horrible level of suicidal feelings. And so the tough thing is, you know, rushing in to help someone where it's a very coveted private thing that we typically don't do. It just almost feels like an invasion force. If you're not being hugged, maybe go get hugged by anybody or anything. You know, I celebrate the fact that the listeners that I know, that actually I'm friends with through the page or whatever, back channels, everyone seems to be doing really well, you know, but we all are human beings. And if nothing else, maybe just put a lot of this, a lot of these suggestions in your back of your mind in case you happen to run into this. And hopefully there's some advice here, even if you don't have a single thought of depression. Just, oh yeah, maybe I should do that. Maybe I should go and make a change and see what happens, right? I know you feel me. If you haven't already, go to mkultureradio.com for all the feeds. There is now a Facebook page for this. People are migrating over. Again, the MKUltra Radio program with Kyle and I is a much different show, as probably some of you have been shocked into realizing. Again, that show is going to remain a podcast. I'm not going to be converting those to YouTube anymore. So you'll need to go to the website and dial it into your podcast reader to get those episodes if you've been traditionally getting them from YouTube. But the Facebook page for this is facebook.com/deepthoughtsradio/. And everything else is just pretty much on the site. So as always, totally appreciate you guys making it here to the end. I've just been very fortunate to have the reception here. I just made one of these on my patio. I showed it to a couple guys. They said it was kind of neat. And so I just kept going, and this is where we are now. So anyhow, thanks for listening. Take care of yourself and somebody else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.